But one of the Italians who works in our center was like, grande, dame, grande, sei cantare, sei bravissimo. I'm really excited. They were like, they were all like, we don't use Spotify, but we're going to download it just to follow you. I was like, yes, yes.
Welcome to Why Different.
Welcome to the Why Different podcast.
He's back.
Yeah.
That is the unmistakable voice of Dr. Tamaresque, who you'll recognise from episode 4. Tamar's back to help me today on this special episode. Instead of the regular format with a creative guest telling us about their story, today we're finding out what you, the listeners, want to know about neurodiversity and the science behind it. The reason for doing this episode is because a lot of these discussions happen between people face-to-face, behind closed doors, or on discussion forums like Reddit, and otherwise with psychiatrists or therapists.
Yeah.
And that leaves a space where there aren't the opportunities to discuss the science and the emerging research of neurodiversity. And it's important to note because a lot of research is going on. And a lot of it...
You're right. Not just a lot of research is going on, but also I think the way that we conduct research now and the outcomes that we pay attention to is changing. It's like a landscape. So it's not just that we're learning more about neurodivergency or mental health or the fact that there is no real difference between physical and mental health. They're all part of the human health. But then we've also got, I don't know anything about psychiatric or studies in neurodivergency, but I work in a group of rare diseases where a recent drug that went to the FDA were like, yeah, we understand the drug might work, but you haven't shown us that it helps people. What's the evidence that you're helping, you're making their life better? So medicine is also changing in that much more patient-centric. You know, what are you doing for me as a person?
Yeah, this is an opportunity to have your questions answered from the perspective of research. And so through social media, I've had a number of questions that have come through, and Dr. T and I are going to take a stab at answering some of those questions using our skills as academics to look through the research, try and make sense of it and deliver it in a manner that's easy to understand. It's important to state at this point that neither of us are specialists in neurodiversity, neither of us are psychiatrists, psychologists, neurologists, research speaking. I'm an immunologist, Tam is a nephrologist. So none of what we are discussing today is medical advice, and you should always get that from your regular doctor.
This advert is only for information purposes. Never take this as gospel. Always seek advice from a medical practitioner, psychologist, psychotherapist, or yeah, that's the terms, terms
basically,
of conditions.
Basically, don't come after us.
Exactly. Keep my name out your mouth, my brother.
Keep my name out your mouth. Also, I think it's quite a good thing. It's not often that you have people that aren't specialists in the clinical setting, but are specialists in understanding research, can provide with information as neurodivergent.
So absolutely.
We're in a unique position whereby we are like the patient. Is that the
absolutely.
You say patient? We are the patient
absolutely.
And the researcher and not the clinician. And so we can give you
a unique perspective.
A unique perspective.
But also, I think what you're saying as well is that medicine has become hyper-specialized. So sometimes when you sit and you talk to the specialist or the psychiatrist or the psychologist, they may have the most scientific opinion or the one with the most accolades, but that may not be the opinion that serves you or even the perspective that's relatable. Mm. And I think what we are able to offer is that we know enough about the science and the structure of healthcare and medicine and disease classification and then medication to combat that. Do you know the way that medicine thinks in these quite siloed tracks? Mm. But then we've also got the personal experience of having been through training as doctors, suffering with our own neurodivergency and the struggles of that, watching other people struggle with the healthcare experience. So it's like it's a multimodal perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And you make a good point, because especially in current times where it's so difficult to get access, it's like in the NHS, the waiting lists are several years for ADHD services. So understandably, people are going to find other sources of information. And some of those places are useful, but it's also important to know the point at which they stop becoming useful. For example, in social media, because a lot of the information is useful. We both see and take advice from social media. But there is also another side of it whereby
absolutely.
commercial motivations.
But I also think, what's the name of this guy, Eddie, the like 80-year-old black guy who's like a bodybuilder? He makes these hilarious videos on Instagram. He's got like 5 million followers. He'll like pick up a protein bar and he'll be like, this is shit. Look at this shit. It's shit. It's chemicals. He does some video about how he's like, protein shake, rubbish. I take 2 chicken breasts and olives and salt and put it in a blender. I was like, bro, what are you drinking raw blended chicken for? Like, what kind of madman are you? But what is incredible about it is that a lot of what he says makes sense and is factual, scientifically factual. Mm. But I find it hard when he swears and it's so like, this works or that works. I was listening to him and I was like, yeah, listen, bro, you're a tough man for drinking raw blended chicken, but some people just would not tolerate. They'd be vomiting for like days. Like, that's what you learn in medicine, right? Is you learn that one medicine works in one person and then doesn't in another, and then gives a side effect in another, and then is a miracle cure in another. So there are loads of factors here that are variable. Yeah. So we can't be sensationalist. We can't have these like polar.
Yeah. And that's a good thing, I think, because as clinical academics, and that means that we are clinicians, but researchers. The value in that is we have qualities that serve both. So from the clinical angle, we're trained and bound by the principles of good medical practice. Tell the truth, you know, be candid. And so we're going to not be sensationalist, as you say. But then as researchers, a large part of what we do is tackling questions that we don't currently have solutions for, which is a bit different to the role of the clinician, which is to practice to the current standards.
Absolutely.
And maintain those. So
absolutely,
this is where we can hopefully add some value. We have some interesting questions.
Well, I'm excited. I mean, I'm not sure how I'm going to be able to answer them, but let's go.
I've taken these questions and done a deep dive into the literature. So I'll read the questions out and start. Come out with what I found and then ask you what you think and what your insights are. So let's roll.
Yeah, also just for the record, guys, George is an actual academic. I'm one of these flash looking academics. Like, it all looks very respectable from the outside. But when you dig down, you crack the, how good am I with a pipette? Not so good.
All right, let's get in. The first question comes from Dr. T himself.
Oh, wow.
You don't remember?
I do. I think it was something to do with trauma and creativity.
I'll read it out for you.
Please.
Is my emotional hypersensitivity what allows me to create, or does it stunt my development as a creative? Now, when you were here before, you were yet to release your music you've been working on.
Yeah.
And now you're 2 singles out.
You just released your
second single, Earth, Wind and Fire, last week.
Yeah, everyone who hears this podcast, can you please go on Spotify, type in Dr. T and listen to Earth, Wind and Fire? Because it's the second single and it's not really getting the love it needs to get as a single. So it's going to have a little plug. It's a little plug for it here.
Yeah, of course. Okay, And since we have you here, just expand on that question and then I'm going to give you some answers and then I'll come back to your reflection.
I think the thing about neurodivergency for me is I oscillate between thinking that I'm having these kind of huge dreams of what I want to achieve and do, and in the one part saying to myself, you're absolutely crazy, Tamer, like you need to get into a straitjacket and be sectioned, because do you really think that you're going to just rediscover yourself as like an artist and a creative at the age of 37 and do this? And then on the other hand, and this sounds very strange, there's a part of me deep down in my core that kind of almost knows that it's going to happen. It's this weird thing. It's this constant, like, weird thing. So that's what I meant. Maybe the question didn't articulate it as well, but I was like, is this emotional? I can only assume it's a hypersensitivity of being very attuned to things. It's hard to work out whether it's, I suppose the best analogy, it's like a fire. Is it fueling me or is it burning things? I don't know. I can't.
It's really interesting what you just said.
Why?
About the fuel and the fire. I wanted to answer this question is to define emotional hypersensitivity, which is heightened intensity in experiencing, processing and reacting to emotions. That's experienced by lots of people. And it ranges from sensitivity to hypersensitivity to projection sensitive dysphoria at more extreme end.
It's dysphoria?
Dysphoria.
Yeah.
So it's like...
I know what euphoria is. It's a great series.
So it's like a damaging emotional response. Let me just find it.
Like euphoria, but that's damaging to you.
Yeah.
Sounds hella familiar.
Yeah. So after defining emotional hypersensitivity, creativity, and its relationship to emotions, and one of the really eminent or forefront researchers in this is Zorana Ivkovic. She's the director of their creativity and emotions lab at Yale in the United States. And one of her studies in 2007 found that people who have highest levels of emotional intelligence, and particularly those who are really skilled at understanding and managing their emotions, they exhibit high levels of emotional creativity. And more recent research focus on the role that emotions play in driving creativity from start to finish. And where I think you said was interesting is that they describe the fuel analogy, which is just like fuel powers an engine, emotions spark creative work, then provide the energy for the creative process, but they need to be regulated to sustain that process.
Yeah.
And then are generated as byproducts of creative output. So just like the fumes. That framework is a great one for you to think about the whole process, because it's not just the coming up with the idea. Recent research looked at how specific emotional states like feeling positive or negative or calm or amped up, how they affect the ability to generate creative ideas. And it happens through multiple pathways, like the fuel analogy. Firstly, personality traits that are tied to emotions. Most importantly, being open-minded, but also things like being extroverted or intrinsically motivated. These things make someone more likely to decide to pursue a creative endeavor in the first place. Also then to choose a creative field and then to stick with the creative activities over a period of time. And during the creative process, being in certain emotional states can boost the ideas that you can generate. Then again, coming back to emotional regulation, you have to be able to regulate your emotions to overcome the frustrations and setbacks that are inevitable when working on creative projects. And the third stage, once you produce a creative work, that triggers emotional responses, both in you, like the feeling of pride or accomplishment, and also in your audience, sort of people being moved or touched by your creativity. So emotions are interwoven throughout creativity, which is interesting. Now, another theory in helping understand emotion and creativity is one that was put forward by a Polish psychologist called Kazimierz Dąbrowski. And this is called the theory of positive disintegration. Dąbrowski believed highly emotionally sensitive people go through a lot of inner turmoil and existential crisis in their lives. I think many people from listening would be nodding at this moment. However, he didn't see this as universally a bad thing. He thought it was actually a necessary step towards higher psychological growth and becoming a more complete person. His theory suggests that emotionally sensitive people successfully work through their intense emotional experiences and the internal conflicts and use those heightened emotions as fuel for personal development and creative expression. And as an emotionally sensitive person, as you progress through the levels of psychological maturity, starting out self-centered to then achieving overall mind, body, emotion harmony, you experience a creative surge that's fueled by your deepening self-awareness and emotional understanding. However, the downside to that is without the skills to manage and cope with the intense emotions, you can become overwhelmed and experience anxiety or depression. And creative types do seem more prone to mood disorders. So that's evidence of the challenges that can come with heightened emotional sensitivity and being creative. So it's a double-edged sword where being highly emotionally sensitive can unlock creativity and self-actualization, but also requires you to be able to cope emotionally to overcome the turmoil that stirs up as a result of that. And I think for many people like ADHD, for example, who have difficulty with executive functioning, which means difficulty regulating their emotions, that's where...
Is that what executive function means, regulating your emotions?
That's one of the elements of it. Executive function is, if you think about an executive in a company like CEO, the CEO is the person who is able to take an overall view, be forward thinking, forward planning, managing all the processes that go on underneath, rather than being like...
A general.
Exactly. But what often happens in people who hyper-focus is you lose sight of the overall picture. Therefore, you don't have the ability to coordinate all of the processes that kind of keep the business going. That's your like inability to manage time or to prioritize tasks, because you get right deep into the week.
It also fits in quite nicely to what I was saying to you, which started us off, which is that since I was like 5 years old dancing to Michael Jackson, I always had this idea that I would release a music video, and I'm
got a meeting on Thursday for my third singles music video. Like, it's a weird, is it a premonition? Is it that you're self-prophesizing? Is it just the really powerful, like, self-narrative of telling yourself want to go? But what you were talking about, the fuel and the journeys and the climbing, like, when I think it was the second chap who said he believes that having that hyper-emotionality isn't a bad thing. It helps you do the self-work on yourself. Mm. I was going to say to you, for me, what then shaped that hypersensitivity and something that growed me was trauma, the loss of my mum and then the loss of my dad. Mm-hmm. So it like honed me. So you're right, it was like this unbridled energy, and then those traumas also both had massive creative releases.
Yeah.
Dance and music.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's very interesting. But again, what I was saying is when I see the future, I see what I want Dr. T to be like in the future. I also can see quite a lot of the steps. I just often don't have the patience to organize it, that all those steps are done methodically and... Mm.
That's what both talk about, regulating your emotions so that you can overcome the challenges. And the challenge is, for many people, overcoming that need for stimulation.
Patience.
To just remain disciplined, in inverted commas, because that is what keeps you going. There does come a point when you have to be able to function without having the really stimulating peaks to get you through. Mm. And I think that's where the regulation comes in, and knowing that this is part of the process to get to where I want to get to. And without having this part, I don't get there, in a sense. And as you mentioned about trauma, that's positive disintegration, where you essentially disintegrate, but then in the process of putting yourself back together, or your mind back together after trauma, you then have that creative surge that leads to emotional healing and development. And culturally, thinking about creatives, we have examples of people who've very highly emotionally sensitive, and that comes with great creative depth, like Vincent van Gogh, who's the embodiment of the tortured artist, right?
The guy chopped his ear off,
Exactly.
Why, bro? Why would you do that?
Sorry?
Why would you do that? Yeah, but just man just chopped his, but also just on a detail thing. That's back in the day, right? How far, how long, that was like at least 100 years. They didn't have no, like, how clean was the cut? Was it like a jagged, imagine if it was like a jagged knife and you just saw in the ear off, like, tug a bit of your cheek.
Your emotions getting off.
It's just an intense thing to hear.
It is.
I find myself creative, but cut my nails off is enough.
Yeah. We all know his work, you know, bold colours, expressive brushstrokes, intense emotional energy. And that's believed to have influenced his struggles with mental health issues. Mm. Sylvia Plath, an American poet and novelist, wrote emotionally charged confessional works. Her work includes a semi-autobiographical novel, The Bell Jar, which is her portrayal of experiences with depression, anxiety and self-doubt, and her ability to transform her emotional pain into poignant, powerful literature. That's why she's well known in the world of creative expression. I guess, what are your thoughts on hearing that? Does it go anywhere to answering your question?
It's just, I think the problem that I find with academic papers and the way that they're presented is they are always trying to... That's why I thought it was interesting that you asked me to do this. I find that they're always trying to rationalize things in a language that I don't even believe in wholeheartedly. So, like, everything that you've said makes sense. But I think, I don't know that it's for anyone to say to someone, this is the right way that your emotions should behave, or this is the wrong way. I think it should all often be directed by the individual and what their life looks like, and whether they're able to live the life and do the things that they want to do. Do you see what I mean?
What came across to you?
It came across as a very logical, methodical analysis. The moment that you said that, and it was a very logical point, creative people are more prone to being depressed or anxious. But you didn't mention about whether creative people are more prone to having true experiences of happiness or bonding to others. So it's like we talked about the two negative things, but we haven't talked about the fact that emotional hypersensitivity also allows me and you to connect in a way that maybe someone who can't have this depth of conversation can't connect with someone.
Yeah.
Maybe. I'm not saying that's the case. I'm saying maybe. So it's portrayed in quite a lot of, like, it just rationalized things in a very sort of rational way, but maybe, it's hilarious, maybe with not as much like emotion, from which maybe I think it's a lot more important than I ever realized.
Yeah, I see your point. I guess hypersensitivity is typically looked at from the damaging effects it has
absolutely
on people's lives.
Absolutely.
which you're right, is perhaps an overly pessimistic way to look at it, but maybe it's just reflective of how people feel about emotional hypersensitivity. Maybe it's that, yeah, the great parts are quite good, but the negative parts are really bad. I'd say that's probably how I would interpret emotional hypersensitivity.
I wouldn't, but I hear exactly what you're saying. I think having lost two of the people in my life who never made me feel hypersensitive, but rather made me feel that I was normal, my mum and my dad, because we were all quite maybe hypersensitive, that was a norm. And coming from a culture where you'll be sitting next to someone, they'll be like, something's wrong, are you okay? Like, you're just quite invasive, quite in your boundaries, you know what I mean? I am upset, I am worried and thinking about something, but I don't really want to talk it with you. So it's having seen all these different, I would say that actually for me, absolutely, like you said, growing up, I wish I was less sensitive. I wish I was more normal, I used to say to my dad. I wish I was less of a, also related to being a man growing up. So I was more tough with things. Whereas now, having life toughen me up a bit, I don't want to lose so much of that thing that makes me feel sad and worry, but also the thing that gives me joy and connection and nostalgia to things, maybe. That makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And
but so it all makes sense. I think the answers all make sense, but also they all actually made my question make a lot more sense because they explored out the different elements to what I was trying to ask. Yeah. Many more steps to it.
So I guess in answer to the question, which was, is my emotional hypersensitivity what allows me to create, or does it stunt my development as a creative? I think it's quite clear that it does both.
Yeah.
And there's a balance to it.
Yeah.
And I guess if you want to tilt the balance in your favor, a reasonable first step would be to try and appreciate and understand how it stunts your development. And what the research shows is that typically it's not in the initializing of creativity, it's usually in sustaining it. And that does tie in with the emotional dysregulation and executive function. So perhaps building in processes that give you perspective and how to reach your goal from the position you currently are at and how to sustain the levels of motivation that are going to allow you to get there, even when you are facing emotional challenges. That's probably a reasonable way to try and get towards
absolutely
optimizing your creativity and harnessing your emotional hypersensitivity.
And the other thing I've learned with creativity is it's a like the producer that I work, Shah, Lord knows, is such a calm energy. I mean, we just, it's such a vibe. And then the mad thing is this other artist that he worked with, Kingin, who came around the other day, we had a studio session, is so like me, quite ADHD, like always hanging over his like his shoulder being like, dude, just change this. It's so funny. And I was like, okay, so this is why you know how to deal with me, because you have this calm energy and you've dealt with. So creatively, I found it really good to like mix with different energies, you know? Really helps me.
Wicked. Okay, the next question is, does Ritalin make me less funny? I've been wondering if I'm less fun or funny on medication. That's from DJ Harold Heath, guest on episode 5.
Okay.
Interesting question. And I went and did a dive into this, and actually there isn't very much evidence at all on humour and ADHD medications. And to give a little bit of background, Ritalin, otherwise called methylphenidate, it's an ADHD medication that helps to increase the availability of dopamine and noradrenaline in the brain, and this can affect attention, executive functions, and potentially creativity as well. And there's no simple answer to this question, because humor is a complex process that involves a lot of different areas in the brain. The effect of Ritalin is difficult to simmer down into yes or no. This is an area that a lot more work needs to go into, but I really enjoyed looking into this question because I didn't realize how many different parts of the brain are involved in the process of humor, which is just one aspect of cognition.
Oh, but it's the most humor is that it's like the ultimate charm.
Yeah.
So it's magic.
It makes sense.
It uses the whole brain.
Right.
Yeah.
A good place to start with this is to discuss how humor is studied from a neurobiological perspective. Typically, researchers use imaging techniques that look at the function of your brain. So things like functional MRI scans or another type called PET scans. And these look at brain activity patterns when people are, for example, here, exposed to humorous material or they're asked to generate humor themselves, say something funny. These studies have identified key areas in the brain that are involved in processing humor. Now, I don't want to go too deep into it because everyone will get bored, but there are three areas in the brain that are really key in creating humor. The prefrontal cortex, the temporal lobes, the mesolimbic dopamine system. Very briefly, the prefrontal cortex is the area at the front of your brain, and that's involved in the cognitive aspects of humor, how you manipulate ideas and information to create or understand a joke. The temporal lobes are the sides of your brain above your ears, and they play a role in what we call semantic knowledge. And so detailed knowledge and language, and then processing the unexpected elements that are really the backbone of humor. Because if you listen to any comedian and they tell you about how they create jokes, etc., it's an unexpected element that makes it funny. And lots of risque comedians play on that. They say things that are completely un-PC when you're expecting them to say something PC, and that's what makes them funny.
I feel like the other thing about a lot of comedians is they live on the line that you're probably not supposed to spend too much time on in this world because you're getting a lot of trouble. They exist on that line.
Yeah.
We play with that line maybe 5% in our life, and they'll spend a good 75% of their life on that line.
Exactly. And the area of the brain that is involved in understanding that is in the temporal lobe. And the third bit, the mesolimbic dopamine system, that's involved in reward processing. The pleasurable feeling that you get when you appreciate humor. It's satisfying when you get a joke. And that comes from that part of the brain. Dopamine is the ultimate reward neurotransmitter for humans. Dopamine is thought to be what contributes to the feelings of enjoyment from humor. So when you break it down, those are the elements of humor and different parts of your brain control each of them. And so if one part of the brain doesn't work in that world,
or your drug acts mainly on one part of the brain, like the limbic region. I can't remember all these words, bro. You sound dumb out here, but it makes sense how it can change what is humor, whether it makes it better or worse or more tilted to one side than being less like dark or sassy or playful. I don't know. There's dark humor, right? There's, you watch things that dark humor, like, ooh, that's not funny, but it is a bit funny. And then you've got the really like silly, playful, like caricature humor.
Yeah, the evidence isn't robust enough to tell us for sure, but speculating, it can make sense that one part of your brain might be really developed in that area to give you a preference for perhaps dark humor or more playful humor, which is quite interesting to know because it allows you to look beyond everything being a character trait of somebody that you can judge them on, right? So now, considering that Ritalin's influencing the availability of dopamine in the brain, a recent study that I looked at talked about how it could affect creativity, and it didn't look specifically at humor, so take this with a pinch of salt. But one of the main features that it had was it broke down areas of the brain that dopamine acts on to tell you how it may influence whether you're funny or not. And one of the specific aspects was a thing called response divergence. That relates to cognitive flexibility. So your ability to switch its thinking quickly from one topic to another. And Ritalin has an effect on an area of your brain called the putamen, which controls this. And in this study where they looked at people's brains in the scanner while they were either watching something funny or creating humor themselves, they found that Ritalin decreased response divergence, so this creative flexibility, and that could in effect hinder your ability to create a range of ideas, and that could potentially reduce your ability to be funny. However, when they looked at the effect of Ritalin on response divergence, they found that it was related to whether you have a low or high baseline level of dopamine function in that part of your brain.
And let me guess.
Go on.
If you've got a high level, it reduces your ability to find things funny or be funny. If you've got a low level, it increases it because it fills you up.
The opposite of that.
You need to cut out that.
Yeah. But so the individuals who have low baseline levels of dopamine in the putamen, so that's just one part of the brain, Ritalin actually decreased their response divergence. So that means that it could have hindered their ability to generate a diverse range of ideas or have diverse responses to something like humor. But in contrast, people who had a high baseline dopamine level, Ritalin increase their response divergence, which possibly enhances flexible thinking. So that potentially means, and again, this is one study and requires more research in a broader range of patients to be able to tell us for certain. But it seems that if you have a low baseline level of dopamine in the putamen, you're less likely to have benefit in response divergence from Ritalin.
Okay.
And actually, in this study, it may potentially have actually reduced.
The other perspective you could take on that is maybe you have a low level because your body doesn't want or need that much. Like it functions better at that low level. And that's where you get. So if you top someone up, they're like, I don't need this. You're moving me away from my. Think about academia, bro. You just look at it from a different perspective and write a little hypothesis.
Yeah, that's part of it. There are lots of different ways to think about things and people have lots of ideas and that's great. What needs to then happen is that you need to test the idea and you test it by showing that what you expect to happen does happen. But then you also test it by checking whether the outcome is related to what you expect to happen or something else. And you do that by having a controlled trial where you'd have, for example, one group who are given the drug and you test if it affects their humor. And then you have another group who weren't given the drug and see if it affects their humor. And that's one way that you'd know it. Again, this is one study and it wasn't specifically designed to look at humor rather than creativity in the brain. But it does give an interesting perspective on the areas of the brain that are involved in generating humor. How important is flexibility in your ideas?
Yeah.
And the effect that
lateral
that dopamine or medications could potentially have on that. And it's a topic that I've heard a lot of people speak about, not just about Ritalin, about any ADHD but Ritalin, stimulant medication.
Ritalin, I got when I did the concierge medicine, Ritalin was the commonest drug that people inquired about.
Sure.
It's also like one of the commonest prescription drugs that's sold on the streets. It's very commonly a drug of abuse. Mm. And it's really interesting hearing you talk about it from a human perspective, because the one thing that I would say about a lot of my friends who have taken Ritalin or used it intermittently is they talk about emotional numbing. And they talk about the fact that, yes, they were hypersensitive before, so it's doing what it needs to do. But of course, they're a bit emotionally numbed from things. I mean, they don't eat, they don't take pleasure in maybe some of the things they would normally do, like socializing or sex. And their partners often report this slight emotional distance.
Yeah.
Like as if they're just a bit numb. They've been numbed by a medicine. So it
absolutely makes. And I think that's where dosing is really important as well. There isn't evidence that I found specifically on that, but you only have to look at Reddit or other forums to see lots of people talking about
dosing,
switching drugs or changing doses because certain elements of their personality were affected by it. And from looking at this one study, the summary is that neurobiology associated with creativity involves complex brain networks that involve language, cognition, emotion, and reward. And that any medication that you give that affects dopamine, which affects these areas, could potentially have an impact. And so if you are feeling that your medication is having an effect that you don't love, then I would explore with your doctor where the dose is optimal for you. And under their guidance, try and keep a record of things like time of day that you took it, whether you'd eaten before or after, whether you'd exercised, whether you'd slept well at each dose. And if you change your dose, keep a record. And with that, see how your mood was or your humor, etc.
It's also the kind of thing where we've talked about ADHD and my sister's been diagnosed and both of us get quite stressed out by the idea of taking a stimulant. Like it just doesn't seem to sit. So I think the other thing that's really interesting about this is that someone who is hypersensitive or thought they were hypersensitive, you know what I'm trying to get to, and they take it and they're like, I feel like my emotions are numb. That's good for you to know that that wasn't the only state you could be in. This is another state you could be in. This is maybe a state you want to be in when life is a certain way or what you call it. But maybe there are times and you want, do you know what I mean? Like the left and the right, one is not positive, one is not negative, one is not good, one is not bad. They're just two sides of a sort of path that you're walking along, trying to find a middle ground which allows you to live the life that you want to live.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. When it comes to these medications, I think it's a really good idea to note down somewhere the parts of your neurodiversity that you find most challenging in order. How do they affect you? So that you have a reference to come back to if you start medication and you know that, okay, this maybe isn't working for me because it might be doing a huge number of good for like your concentration, for example.
Well, that's the thing.
But maybe it's doing that at the expense of other elements, perhaps of your personality. And it's quite hard, of course. with ADHD, or if you are struggling with working memory, it's quite hard to remember what it was like before you started the medications. And so having it written down means that you can come back to it.
People tell me some mad stuff about... Someone told me, some guy who remained nameless, very smart guy, wrote up his PhD. Like, I wrote my PhD over the course of a year by writing the 10 papers that form my chapters. He wrote it in 4 days, bro. And I was like, what? So obviously he had notes, right? He must have had the graphs. And as you call me on SPSS, like, yeah. But he put it all together. And apparently he basically just smashed it for 4 days. Like, the productivity is also quite addictive. If you're already quite smart and quite accomplished, you're doing a PhD, right? And then you can achieve that much. I wonder whether that kind of makes you think, maybe I should sacrifice the other parts of my personality for this. Because it's what society tells. This is the dream, right? Ultimate performance, ultimate efficiency. It's quite like a, yeah.
I think, yeah, really focusing on what you want to get out of your treatment. Because I guess from the other point of view, if you're looking at it from the point of view of a psychiatrist, psychiatrists can't necessarily know what your treatment goals are. Because there are so many different ways in which people with ADHD, for example, are affected. And therefore, there are so many things that you can want out of a treatment. But knowing which ones are the most important for you and trying to keep a track, recording it at intervals so that you know where you are and how happy you are with it, I think that might be a good idea.
So it's just a very good idea to take that proactive approach of knowing what your... It's like the patient who comes to the clinic with their blood pressure.
Mm.
And you're like, oh, your blood pressure's high today. They're like, funny you should say that. Here's my booklet. Your blood pressure's fine. Sorry for...
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry for accusing you. All that sort of sense of...
That's a really good point. We see that in so many areas.
In so many diseases. We know that a single snapshot, whether it's 2 hours with a psychiatrist once a month. Okay, but that's 2 hours of a 24-hour day that you've had 30 of those 24-hour days before.
Yeah.
So if you have a wearable that tracks what your sleep was like or what your energy level, your activity like, or you have whatever, if someone has a much more holistic assessment of you in the entirety of your oscillations of day and night.
Yeah, it's useful. Whenever I see patients come in with some evidence of tracking what's happening, then that's useful. However, the caveat, because there's the other side, which especially in people prone to hyperfocus could be detrimental, and that is being overly obsessed with the numbers. Because if you get too obsessed with the numbers, actually you might have too much information, which then stops you from appreciating the bigger picture.
Yeah.
And two, if you become too obsessed with it, it can just negatively affect your life because you're paying too much attention to it. And that has a potential to make you more anxious. So, for example, when I see skin cancer patients, absolutely, I want you to check your skin once a month. And that's what the recommended guidance is. Exactly, not once a day. Like, don't be crazy about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Just know that if you do see something, give us a call.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's your responsibility. Otherwise, spend...
And it's a very hard balance to find.
Yeah.
It's a very hard balance. I was just saying to my colleague that I used to read my letters on average before sending them out 7 or 8 times, having made all the edits on the first 2 times.
Yeah.
I just can't seem to press send.
Yeah.
And that was just not helping anyone.
Mm.
Wasn't helping me, wasn't helping the people waiting to get my letter that don't care about the one spelling mistake or the word that is out. And they're like, yeah, but I get what you mean. It's not that big a deal. I needed the information 2 weeks. Just see what I mean? Like, that's the...
Yeah.
So that's a very good example of how...
Yeah. I think discuss where you can, but otherwise, I think keep a record of where you think you are in terms of what your goals are. Are they still the goals you want? And what do you want to improve? And then once you know that, I think you're in a good position to be able to move towards that in a productive way.
Absolutely.
Great. So thanks, Harold, for that question. All right, next question. Oh, this is an interesting question. The next question comes from Laura. Sent it through Instagram. Thank you, Laura. Laura's question was, how come I can't follow a recipe, but I also feel exhausted by the idea of cooking creatively? What do you think of that?
If I can't follow a recipe, but I'm also exhausted by the idea of cooking creatively.
Yeah.
I would tell her to do...
Do you identify with that?
I would I never follow a recipe. I always use the recipe as a spine and then do my own shit on top of it. And it always turns out banging. Because the recipes generally don't have enough salt, don't have enough chili for me, and often don't have enough garlic. So I'll tell Laura, do your thing. Take that recipe and turn it, Laura-fy it.
I don't think she's saying that she doesn't choose to follow the recipe. She says, how come I can't follow a recipe?
I just download Deliveroo in it. Similar question to my one, isn't it? In the sense of, is this
sword double-edged.
Yeah, it is. And I think this really at the heart of it is a question about executive dysfunction. And when I've looked into the literature, there isn't a huge amount. But one thing I found interesting was a way that researchers and occupational therapists assess executive functions in people who, for example, may have had traumatic brain injuries. So that means that a part of their brain may have been injured and therefore either isn't functioning properly or at all. A way that they assess is using what they call the cooking task. So okay. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Because you're right on it, Laura. That cooking is a task that tests your entire executive function because it involves complex multitasking, planning, and sustaining your attention. And these are skills that people with ADHD often face challenges with, but because, of course, ADHD greatly affects executive functioning. And the literature shows that tasks such as the cooking task that demand multiple cognitive processes highlight the problems that are experienced by people who suffer with that, including people with ADHD. Now, the studies that I've looked at on traumatic brain injury, the cooking task is designed to test planning and organization, working memory, inhibitory control, task switching, and sustained attention. I'll go through them one by one. Planning and organization, what this means is that to be able to cook, you have to be able to plan and organize, and that means you must envision the finished meal, understand all the steps required to achieve it, and organize the timing and the sequence of steps to get there. You have to use your working memory. So holding several pieces of information in mind at the same time, the ingredients, quantities, cooking times. You need to have inhibitory control and ability to task switch. So resist distractions, switch smoothly between tasks like chopping vegetables while also monitoring a simmering pot. And then to stay on your attention, which means maintain focus on the process of cooking so that all of the tasks are completed correctly and, of course, safely. Even just thinking about all of those things makes me, I don't cook very often. But what's strange is I'm really comfortable and love operating. So it's probably context dependent, but
absolutely.
I know literally every time I do an operation, I'm massively stimulated, even if I've done it 100 times, which is perhaps part of it. Because cooking, unless I'm cooking something that I think is going to be really banging, I'm not that stimulated. And so I'm just like, oh, whatever. So I think maybe that kind of comes into it.
I also think cooking is something that requires passion and love. And I think you have passion and love for surgery. You have passion and love for healing people. And someone like my dad, for example, who had very bad ADHD, but he was an incredible cook. Bit heavy on the salt, I must say, Dad, RIP. But you are a bit heavy. He was a bit heavy on the salt, George. Dina's also, love you, Dina, but she's also a bit... But very good cooking, like just this... You talked about it like it was stressful when you were talking about the chopping the vegetables, and I love cooking. And I don't find it very stressful at all because I'm always like, the fact that I can make this taste better and better is like a... Yeah, it's quite like a fun project for me. But I do know that when I'm in a bad mood and I try and cook, the food tastes rubbish. Big thing in me.
Interesting. So that's why can't I follow a recipe, I guess. Now let's look at cooking creatively. And I guess it's... would seem at face value that this is going to be more relaxed and free-flowing, but actually it can be just as demanding cognitively, if not more so. Because to cook creatively, you have to rely on your own knowledge, intuition, your problem-solving skills, and this requires flexible thinking, decision-making, and improvising, and all are quite taxing. So flexible thinking came up before when we're talking about humour. And it's interesting that the two questions are tackling similar elements. There is a common thread between them. You said that you freestyle.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, there are some basics, like I can just make hearty home-cooked food that you can eat and be full with and has nutrients in it. And so I don't know. It's creative, but it's also got quite a framework. Like, you'll never once see me, like, starting cooking something in a pan or a wok without some olive oil and the onions. Do you see what I mean? There's, like, a routine to how I cook.
Right, yeah.
So creative, but... within a framework.
In creating cooking, things that would be involved are substituting ingredients, adjusting cooking times, coming up with flavor combinations on the fly. And this level of flexibility can be mentally taxing because it requires constantly adapting and thinking quickly. And it actually harps back to what we were talking about in your question about not just the buzz of the creative idea, you also need to be able to sustain it. And I find that I'd like to substitute one or two things in, but then... if that doesn't taste very nice, I lose the motivation.
And I'm just like, this isn't buzzing me anymore. What you're describing is that the people who are the best chefs are often savory. You very rarely meet a chef that's a savory chef and a sweet, because a sweet chef, there is no substituting. Dina and my dad used to always say, neither of them are good at cooking sweets because you have to stick to the rules. Baking, it's exact proportions. So that's very interesting how within the, within cooking, it lends for two different skill sets. And that's, I think, quite a common thing that you when you talk about chefs, like they have, they're either sweet or savory, like they have their...
That's interesting there, because Heston Blumenthal, and he's a triple Michelin star chef. He's ADHD, and he was famed for mixing it up, like trying odd combinations. He speaks about knowing that, oh, that's going to work. Those two things.
My dad used to say that. And it's mad because when you're cooking, like one time I've over-seasoned something and then my sister's like, it's calm, get a lemon from the fridge. And I was like, what's a lemon going to do? And it just, and it made it taste even better.
Yeah.
Because it has this acidic, like it's cut through the fat and it's got a slight tang and you're like, damn, I'm like Michelin style right now. And that's apparently a very basic thing, fat and oil and acid. Like it's a very scientific thing.
Yeah.
Salt and sugar. If you've over-seasoned, you add a bit of sugar.
And I think Heston created the, what's it called? The scientific cooking. I can't remember what the name is. You know, when you have, if you go for like some tasting menus and they'll bring out this thing that looks like an olive and then you put it into your mouth and then it's just this like eruption of crazy contrasting flavors, but they're just unbelievably well together. Yeah. Like fireworks. I think he came up with that. So when I used to go to the cinema, I used to wait for everyone to go and buy the popcorn and go inside.
I swear.
And then I'll come back and then be like, yeah, can I have the sweet and the salty, please?
Yeah, always, bro.
So I used to get rinsed.
So normal. No, that's now it's so a big normal, thing. Bro.
They never used to sell that when we were kids,
that's
though,
so
right?
So normal. That's because you were cutting edge. You were sweet and salt is
weird, isn't it?
I think it's perfect.
It is now. Yeah. Get back to it. It's difficult because the other element is decision making. Without having a recipe, you have choices at every step, really. Which ingredients should I use? How much seasoning, like you're saying? How long should we cook each component for? Making all of these decisions can be overwhelming. Especially if you're prone to decision fatigue or analysis paralysis, like lots of people.
Analysis paralysis.
Then you're, because you're always trying to make the perfect dish. And in a sense, you may fall victim to your creativity being stunted.
I think also you've just touched on what I was asking about being perfect. That's what I was probably, that's a much more eloquent way of putting down my question, which was, is it part of what lets me create and be great, or is it something that stifles that pressure? That was a very important experience with the music, listening to my music and being like, this doesn't sound perfect, but I'm not sure I'm trying to make something sound perfect right now. I think I'm just trying to understand what I'm saying and putting it out there and growing from there. There's a vulnerability to that. It's like when I told you that my mum never left the house without being presentable and presented with things. Perfection is quite a destroyer of experience.
Yeah, so the challenges of both following recipes and cooking creatively. Have you seen the film Ratatouille?
I've heard of the film Ratatouille. Is it a cartoon?
Yeah.
I have seen it, yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's a story of this, because the rat Remy, he was like passionate about cooking but couldn't follow strict recipes and rules of being in the kitchen. And he'd like experiment and explore his own ideas. Yeah, I think that's like a popular culture reference to a similar thing, that tension between structure and creativity. And I guess in the bake-off as well, when you talk about the creativity and baking, there is an element of it
where you are having to, but I think it's less than savory. I think you have to be much more, like, for example, savory, you can get away with not being that, like the stove getting a bit too hot. Oh shit, I need to take this off. And like the rice being a bit like undercooked and be like, oh, I need to hustling. I don't think you can do that with baking. I think the rules are much tighter. If you leave something for a minute in longer and it was like 25 minutes, it's not the same as like leaving something in the oven or on the stove for an extra minute. I think the currency is much more.
You do see that with Bake Off. Right, if you're like making, I don't know, souffle or something like that, and then it collapses if you left it just that minute longer. Yeah, it's not that forgiving. No, I see that point. Laura, in summary, that was a really interesting question that touches on executive dysfunction and highlights why those different elements would be taxing on the brain until you understand, oh yeah, I'm doing that.
That's
and
why
that,
you're doing
and
all
that,
of that.
And that. Yep. And that. And it's borne out in the science. That's the way you would assess whether somebody who has had a brain injury is safe enough to go home and look after themselves. And of course, traumatic brain injury and ADHD are not the same thing. Definitely not. But if executive function is one of the issues that you struggle with, then it's likely that it's going to bear itself out in how you experience cooking. But there are some solutions that can help. And one of those sources is by Linda Yee, who runs a cooking course called The Panda Cub Diner, where she teaches students about how to make Sichuan food, which is her family's delicacy. And she was diagnosed with ADHD at age 25 after struggling for a long time, as many people do with ADHD, not knowing what was wrong. Her story is really interesting because after starting her treatment, she then started to learn how to cook. And she's created a number of ADHD-friendly cooking techniques that, looking at them, seem really useful, and I'd definitely like to try. So the first one is to separate feeding yourself from cooking for fun. And the way she describes this is there are two problems. Firstly, that we're hungry and need to feed ourselves. But secondly, our brains are seeking activities that can maintain our interest. So the first tip is to create a minimal prep meal plan that gets you through your low executive function days, because it's difficult to cook on an empty stomach considering all the executive function that's required. And so she creates a meal plan and she illustrates it all so that it's nice and easy for her to see what she's going to be using. And examples on the websites are things like frozen dumplings. Another one is like simple guacamole and chips. So having that meal plan and having a stocked fridge and pantry full of the things you'll need gives you like fallbacks that you can used to free you up, so you can actually look forward to preparing things that are a little bit more creative. Yeah. A second tip is find your why, schedule a date, write down why it is that you want to learn how to cook, and then tie it into a specific date, like an event or something that's going to stimulate you, and update your calendar. The third tip is to make your kitchen an inviting space that you'd want to cook in, because often people avoid cooking not because of the activity, but because the tasks surrounding it can drain your motivation. If you've got a sink full of dirty dishes, that's going to be demotivating. One tip I really liked was recipe cards that are visual. So you're not reading the instructions. You're actually just looking at illustrations, showing you what you need instead of telling you what you need, showing you what the steps are. And it's actually a really nice hack, because looking at her illustrations that've got like salt, sugar and soy sauce, etc., it somehow just makes it more appealing and look easier to handle for me. So take a look and see if it helps you. Cool, and I'm gonna wrap this up. You can find all of her tips, just search Linda Yee and you'll find them all on there. Thanks, Laura. And I guess we have one more question. Should we do one more?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okie dokie.
Browski.
Cool. And last question that we can fit in today, and I'm sorry if your question hasn't got on here, we'll try and do it the next time we do our question episode, comes from Amy, who mentioned she'd recently been poorly with gastrointestinal symptoms, so sickness, loose stools, and found that her mental health and cognitive function suffered during that time. And she wanted to know, what's the connection between gut health and mental health, and what can be done to improve the connection? First, most important thing is, if you're unwell, to see a doctor to find out if there is an organic cause that needs to be treated or ruled out. However, the question of the connection between gut health and mental health, this is a rapidly expanding field of research and complex. And Tam, you'll probably be interested in this, because
absolutely.
I know you as a nutrition expert.
Yeah, absolutely. It's also a huge part. The microbiome is becoming like it's its own DNA. Gina's a huge believer in this.
Your sister?
Yeah, huge believer.
What someone described is the connection between gut health and mental health is the gut-brain axis. And the gut-brain axis is a communication network that links the enteric nervous system, which is the nervous system of your digestive tract, with the central nervous system, which essentially is in your brain. And the interesting thing, and probably most people don't know, is that the enteric nervous system is the biggest part of what we call the peripheral nervous system. So all the nerves that exist outside of your brain and your spinal cord, everywhere in your body. And the biggest part of that is all situated in your gut. And that tells you that it's doing a lot of stuff. And recent evidence has linked that to mental health, psychological and psychiatric disorders. And disturbances in your gut health can affect this communication and therefore can affect your mental health and your cognitive functioning. We can start by talking about the ways these two things are connected and how you can improve it. Now, a study found that young adults with ADHD are more likely to have GI problems such as constipation and diarrhea compared with people who don't have it. And later research has shown that we have trillions of bacteria in our digestive system, and they have a strong influence on your mental health and in conditions including ADHD. And these trillions of bacteria are known, as Tamer mentioned, as your gut microbiome. To give you the top line, will it affect your metabolism, what type of nutrients you're likely to absorb, and also the development of your brain, immune system, whether you have inflammation, which can be damaging, and also what we call the neuroendocrine system. So that's the hormones and their effects on nerves and your brain. A few areas that are discussed in some of the top, in some of the new well-cited reviews. One, the gut microbiome is involved in the development of your brain and your nervous system. So it influences your emotions and behavioral responses. Also, as you can imagine, the way we live in the modern world has an impact on the gut microbiome. We change our diets frequently, the kind of foods that we put into our bodies.
Travel.
It can all affect the bugs that essentially are growing within us. And those bugs are interacting with our nervous system and can affect conditions, including ADHD and autism. As well as that, lifestyle, exercising, medications, and the types of medications that you take, they can alter the gut microbiome in different ways. And that's not to say that all medications are bad. That's a common thing that we hear, and that's, in fairness, utter bullshit.
That all medications are bad?
Yeah.
I think that is utter bullshit, because medications save lives. It's why we have the arrogance to say that medications are bad, because people... children were dying of bacterial infections and never having a chance. But I think when people talk about the effect medications has on the gut and how much that's been ignored, and the microbiome, whether it's, you know, immunosuppressants or whatever, I think that's a very valid concern. And doctors are very quick to be like, if you've got diarrhea, take a constipator. If you've got constipation, take a laxative. But that's not fixing the, you know, the...
So yeah, yeah.
I
totally agree with that. Yeah, 100%. You know, on one extreme, the idea that all medications are bad for you and that all medications like destroy your gut microbiome is not true. But what is true is that there hasn't been enough understanding or attention given to the effect
or value given to
the effect that medications can have on your gut microbiome. And those are important to recognize, because they should influence whether you're given a medication, take a medication, what type of medication you take, how long you take the medication for, because they will have effects on other parts of your body that should be taken into account.
Absolutely. And one of the other things is that, just to do a bit of a segue, is that it's also really important that if you believe the microbiome is directly linked to mental health and your mental kind of well-being, and then you look at the fact that we've now just announced, the WHO, that 1 in 6 people is obese. I mean, we're dealing with now a new like epidemic of malnutrition in its own manner. Epidemic.
Right.
So yeah, so it's kind of mad, right? It's like...
There's a lot of chatter, and there's some research on which supplements, nutrients are good for ADHD. And because the evidence isn't robust, there isn't a consensus. One thing that the evidence is a bit clearer on is that omega-3 fatty acids do improve ADHD symptoms in a number of studies. Therefore, that would be one to consider.
Absolutely.
If you are not already including it. It influences your gut microbiome and brain neurology, and is one worth considering. Probiotics, lots of companies are really pushing probiotics, and there are benefits to it, but it's oversold. The most recent research doesn't show a significant therapeutic benefit, and some commentators think that maybe is because you're just putting one type of bacteria into you and putting lots of it, and the potential risk of that is that it outcompetes the other bacteria. And actually what you need in your gut microbiome is diversity. You want a really broad microbiome of lots of different types of bacteria, because those will all have different effects on different parts of your body. So the potential to improve certain conditions like your mental health or autoimmunity or cancer, etc., the same bacteria is unlikely to have that range of effects, but having a broad microbiome is. And the way you get a broad microbiome is to have a diverse diet of naturally growing fruit, veg, nuts, pulses, and as well as that, colors. Different colors give you information about the types of bacteria that the fruit and veg are interacting with as they're developing. And so you're likely to interact inside you with a broad range if you are experiencing all these different foods. So darkly coloured leaves, like the purplish, slightly bittery ones, the red tomato colours, the greens. You want to have as many of those as you can in your diet in a week. Like some people target 30 different types, and I know that of course might be expensive, so try and get as broad a range as you can with as many as you can really afford or incorporate reliably into your diet.
You and Dina get on like a house on fire, bro. She talks about the colour of her vegetables like it's artwork.
It is cool. Like, if you're going to take a photograph of...
I'm not worried about the coolness, I'm worried about the taste.
It's true. I think that's another thing to think about with your diet and the gut microbiome, etc. Processed and synthetic foods absolutely destroy it.
Yep.
You'll have a really narrow microbiome, and then you'll be prone to things like inflammation, which has a negative effect in your body, including mental health and cognitive function. So trying to avoid those is key. And a problem is they are packed synthetically with salty flavors, sweet flavors, all the things that release dopamine, make you feel good in the short term. But actually in the long term, because they destroy your microbiome and have no nutritional value, affect your symptoms more broadly in subtler ways than you perceive at the time. And so it's important to consider that, because as a neurodivergent, you'll be perhaps more in tune with how impactful swings in your dopamine levels can be on your general happiness. And so you want to try and reduce those. And something that I'm thinking about a lot more at the moment is trying to reduce the potential for like highly sweet or highly savory foods to give me that buzz. Because that's when you fall into the trap of just binging all the time. And you don't want to get into that. Also, they don't keep you full for very long. So you end up binging
a lot of high quality nutrition.
And then you keep having peaks and troughs in how stimulated you are, overstimulated, understimulated, And I think that over time, that leads you on a steady kind of downward trajectory. I don't have evidence for this, but putting together the bits of evidence that we do have, I think we know that high nutrient density foods like fruit and veg, especially when you don't boil or grill or cook them into oblivion, so they still have the elements you have to break down, like a cell wall, they stay in your tummy and they take a longer time to digest, and therefore you don't feel hungry so often. And so what you want to try and do is have foods that aren't over-processed or overcooked. If you're having your celery, you want to have that crunch, right? I hate celery. It's the taste of it. And
the thing that I really like about the vegetables is I like cucumbers, carrots, celery. Like, I eat a lot of crudités. I don't really like cooked vegetables. I find them quite like sloppy and slushy. But then I love rice. It's funny listening to you talk. Me and my sister have very different dietary habits. We've always liked different things. She's got a very sweet tooth. I've never really had that. The one thing that I would say that you are spot on is that the three things that are just toxic to the human body and are very clearly toxic are refined sugar. We know what refined sugar does to the body. And we know that we have an excess of it, and we have an excess of it matched with a serious level of inactivity.
Yeah. Refined sugars and sweeteners.
Yeah. Trans fats, I think we know are unhealthy because they're not natural fats. I think you're better off eating a piece of lard, as you can see from all these skinny soldiers in World War II, like a piece of lard on a piece of bread. There's no vegetable there. There's no green there. There's no whatchacallit there. But it's a natural source of energy. And like the Eskimos eat lard just because of the constant need for consumption and energy, and are also slightly overweight, are not lean. So trans fats, but trans fats that have been like refried, triple fried, four fried, and they're sort of cooking oils, I think are very bad. And then the last thing,
I can't remember what the last
one was, but I'm sorry. And then what you said, George, ultra processed foods. And when you talk about ultra processed foods, you're basically talking about like white loaves of bread that you like take a bite into, and you're like, oh my God, this is like a cake. Do you see what I mean? Like ultra processed meats, just everything that's been ultra processed.
If there's one thing I recommend, it's trying to incorporate in your diet more of the natural kind of blander foods. Because the way I like to think of it, and it makes sense in my brain, is when you have foods that are ultra stimulating and you have them often, it's kind of that feeling of when you're like, spend a weekend and you watch too many things that are massively stimulating.
Yeah.
Like you've just watched an action film, a horror film, and then you just watch a penalty shootout and you'd feel like, I just want to lie down and watch something that's really easy and isn't stimulating.
Yeah.
I think it's a similar, like if you keep doing that, you get into that crazy phase. So I think if you try and reduce very stimulating foods, you will just start to balance out. You'll start to need them less, because I think that you'd crave them less because your brain would stop looking for them. And whereas it might be harder at the start, after a while, with a bit of perseverance, it will settle. But with that in mind, I think an important thing to also say is, if changing your diet, one way to ensure that it won't be sustainable is to do it really quickly. So you definitely want to try and incorporate things slowly, like maybe I definitely want to have a piece of fruit or veg or something in my diet that I feel a real crunch when I go through it. Because that crunch means that you're going to have to break down that cell wall to be able to get the nutrients out of it. And that's your body using energy to do it. And also it means that it's going to take your body longer. And therefore, you're going to feel fuller for longer, and you're not going to be in the sweetie jar as often.
Yeah, I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense, and it's generally very astute advice. All I would say is that from my personal experience, I've had a very sort of strange relationship with food that's culminated in, I didn't really eat as a child, and my dad was very worried about me being underweight. I was very skinny. And then after mum's death, I was like, I need to be musty. I need to go to the gym. And I was eating like 2 steaks a day. And then I went through my gay phase of like training twice a day and 8% body fat and eating basically chicken breast and sweet potato and broccoli and like 4 pieces of broccoli, 300 grams of chicken breast. Like I had an extremely dysfunctional relationship with food.
Right.
So much so that I would go to my sister and my dad's house, and they were like, you're bringing your own Tupperware full of bland, dry chicken, and dad's just spent 10 hours cooking you like roast lamb and like Egyptian delicacies. You know, they were like, this is damaging your... So I think these things need to be taken into the context of like your relationship with food and your emotions. So I think also it's about understanding why we have our eating habits, why we eat that way. Do you see what I mean? I found there are certain foods that I can eat. Like I can't eat haggis, bro. I can't eat haggis. I can't eat like raw red meat. Like I can't do it. I have to have my meat cooked. And that's a very like thing that I feel very comfortable eating, grilled Middle Eastern, like Levantine food. It's just, it's easy to digest. I take it in it. Rice, meat, like it's just, I can't cope with the butters and the creams and the lactose. Like there are just these sort of, I'm not saying people have to stick to them. I'm saying the guidance of maybe where that.
You have to enjoy your food. And that's why, again, it's not about having very large shifts in your lifestyle and diet, because I don't think that those are sustainable. I think it is trying to have the small incremental changes and understanding why you want to change your diet, if you do. Because if it is affecting your ADHD symptoms, it's probably one of the things that you can address that will make you happier or in your lifestyle. Yeah, I think the take homes from this, the probiotic story is still immature. There is some evidence that probiotics improve ADHD or autistic spectrum disorder symptoms, but other studies refute that. And overall, its therapeutic value, or the therapeutic value of different probiotics, is yet to emerge. Having said that, one way that you can definitely have a more broad microbiome is by having a broad range of fruit, veg, nuts and pulses, things that have grown naturally. Thank you very much, Amy, for that question. That's a really useful question, and one that I think we should look back on and continue to dissect as the evidence emerges. Cool. A lot of questions that we've gone through. I hope it wasn't too didactic or boring, and I hope that you'll take something from it. And let us know what you think on our social media @_wiredifferent on Instagram. And also you can contact Tama.
Slide into Tama Puppy MD's DMs.
Tama Puppy MD.
Ask him any scientifically where he has no scientific answer related questions. There you go.
Thanks for doing this one with me, because actually, you know, it's a bit nerve-wracking for us.
It's very difficult. What you're trying to do is a very complicated space of both taking a question, understanding that question, contextualizing it, taking the evidence, making it understandable but not too simplified, but appreciating the variety of what someone needs to get from your, and then moving from topic to topic. So I think it's a hard task that you did very well.
We did it. Follow and subscribe on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, because that way you'll be notified when the next episodes come out.
Sounds like a plan.
Sounds like a plan. Tama.
Always a pleasure.
On the outro, we're going to play your newest track.
Earth, Wind & Fire. Okay,
Earth, Wind & Fire. And you can find it on Spotify. We'll catch you next time on Wired Different. Take care.
Peace.
Shots fired, yeah. Times, baby. She strong, she fire, kind heart, heart's mine. She like my vibe, my kink, my tribe. She sticks, ride or die. Fresh creps, slim waist, pussy divine. Everything she wants, cause she my queen, my earth, wind and fire. I ride, I rap, no cap, flash cap. I'm an expert, you know. Corporate got me nice, got me flexed up, you know. Got money, no hoes. Got honey, no pros. Got rollie, no joke. More rollies than you got homies, my G for sure. Huh, tongue sharp. Wet you up, no word of a lie. Huh. Words harsh, bullets cost more caskets than bouquets. Life flawless, two coffins, no kids, still orphan. TikTok is dawning, life hard, real time soldier since time. I need you, well baby that's alright. Cause I'ma wait until I said the end of the night. End of the night, that's right. Keep our shit together cause they come in tonight. Come in tonight, shots fired. Trying times, baby, let's stick together and fight. It's gonna be alright one time. Yeah. Yo, huh. They talk shit. Step down in a ninja, he a freak. Step down in his title, he ain't shit. Stay down, you little boy, you ain't it. Well, damn if I heard you, cause you'll talk fear. Huh. I astound you dudes, melanin king, words profound to you. I reuse these jewels, Malcolm, thanks to you. Self-love, crown me boo. Don't need negativity, LV bags full of abuse. Self-hate, self-flagellation, Christian hate, and you take wrapped up in these fucking toxic traits.
I need you, yeah, yeah. Well, baby, that's alright. Cause I'ma wait until I say the end of the night. End of the night, that's right. Keep our shit together, cause they come in tonight. They come in tonight, shots fired. Trying times, baby, let's stick together.